This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter and directed by Kathleen Gormley. This book is copyrighted 2005 by Diana Gabaldon. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. The year is 1772, and on the eve of the American Revolution, the long fuse of rebellion has already been lit. Men lie dead in the streets of Boston, and in the backwoods of North Carolina, isolated cabins burn in the forest. With chaos brewing, the governor calls upon Jamie Fraser to unite the backcountry and safeguard the colony for king and crown. But from his wife, Jamie knows that 3 years hence, the shot heard around the world will be fired, and the result will be independence, with those loyal to the king either dead or in exile. And now, A Breath of Snow and Ashes.
Prologue. Time is a lot of the things people say that God is. There's the always pre-existing and having no end. There's the notion of being all-powerful, because nothing can stand against time, can it? Not mountains, not armies. And time is, of course, all healing. Give anything enough time, and everything is taken care of. All pain encompassed, all hardship erased, all loss subsumed. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Remember, man, that thou art dust, and unto dust thou shalt return. And if time is anything akin to God, I suppose that memory must be the devil. Part 1. Rumours of War. Chapter 1. An Interrupted Conversation. The dog sensed them first. Dark as it was, Ian Murray felt, rather than saw, Rollo's head lift suddenly near his thigh, ears pricking. He put a hand on the dog's neck and felt the hair there ridged with warning. So attuned as they were to each other, he didn't even think consciously, men, but put his other hand to his knife and lay still, breathing, listening. The forest was quiet. It was hours till dawn, and the air was still as that in a church, with a mist like incense rising slowly up from the ground. He had lain down to rest on the fallen trunk of a giant tulip tree, preferring the tickle of woodlice to seeping damp. He kept his hand on the dog, waiting. Rollo was growling, a low, constant rumble that Ian could barely hear, but felt easily, the vibration of it travelling up his arm, arousing all the nerves of his body. He hadn't been asleep. He rarely slept at night any more, but had been quiet, looking up into the vault of the sky, engrossed in his usual argument with God. Quietness had vanished with Rollo's movement. He sat up slowly, swinging his legs over the side of the half-rotted log, heart beating fast now. Rollo's warning hadn't changed, but the great head swiveled, following something unseen. It was a moonless night. Ian could see the faint silhouettes of trees and the moving shadows of the night, but nothing more. Then he heard them, sounds of passage, a good distance away but coming nearer by the moment. He stood and stepped softly into the pool of black under a balsam fir. A click of the tongue and Rollo left off his growling and followed, silent as the wolf who had been his father. Ian's resting place overlooked a game trail. The men who followed it were not hunting. White men. Now that was odd, and more than odd. He couldn't see them, but didn't need to. The noise they made was unmistakable. Indians travelling were not silent, and many of the Highlanders he lived among could move like ghosts in the wood. But he had no doubt whatever. Metal, that was it. He was hearing the jingle of harness, the clink of buttons and buckles, and gun barrels. A lot of them. So close he began to smell them. He leaned forward a little, eyes closed, the better to snuff up what clue he could. They carried pelts. Now he picked up the dried, blood, cold fur smell that had probably waked Rollo. But not trappers, surely. Too many. Trappers moved in ones and twos. Poor men, and dirty. Not trappers, and not hunters. Game was easy to come by at this season, but they smelled of hunger, and the sweat of bad drink. Close by now, perhaps 10 feet from the place where he stood. Rollo made a tiny snorting sound, and Ian closed his hand once more on the dog's ruff, but the men made too much noise to hear it. He counted the passing footsteps, the bumping of canteens and bullet boxes, footsore grunts and sighs of weariness. 23 men he made it, and there was a mule, no, 2 mules with them. He could hear the creak of laden panniers and that querulous, heavy breathing, the way a loaded mule did, always on the verge of complaint. The men would never have detected them, but some freak of the air bore Rollo's scent to the mules. A deafening bray shattered the dark, and the forest erupted in front of him with a krishma klaver of crashing and startled shouts. Ian was already running when pistol shots crashed behind him. A year! Something struck him in the head and he fell headlong. Was he killed? No. Rollo was pushing a worried wet nose into his ear. His head buzzed like a hive and he saw bright flashes of light before his eyes. "Rich!" he gasped, pushing at the dog. "Run out! Go!" The dog hesitated, whining deep in his throat. He couldn't see, but felt the big body lunge and turn back, undecided. "Rich!" He got himself up onto hands and knees, urging, and the dog at last obeyed, running as he had been trained. There was no time to run himself, even if he could have gained his feet. He fell face down, thrust hands and feet deep into the leaf mould, and wriggled madly, burrowing in. A foot struck between his shoulder blades, but the breath it drove out of him was muffled in wet leaves. It didn't matter. They were making so much noise. Whoever had stepped on him didn't notice. It was a glancing blow as the man ran over him in panic, doubtless thinking him a rotted log. The shooting ceased. The shouting didn't, but he made no sense of it. He knew he was lying flat on his face, cold damp on his cheeks, and the tang of dead leaves in his nose, but felt as though very drunk, the world revolving slowly round him. His head didn't hurt much, past the first burst of pain, but he didn't seem able to lift it. He had the dim thought that if he died here, no one would know. His mother would mind, he thought, not knowing what had become of him. The noises grew fainter, more orderly. Someone was still bellowing, but it had the sound of command. They were leaving. It occurred to him dimly that he might call out. If they knew he was white, they might help him, and they might not. He kept quiet. Either he was dying, or he wasn't. If he was, no help was possible. If he wasn't, none was needed. "Well, I asked then, didn't I?" he thought, resuming his conversation with God, calm as though he lay still on the trunk of the tulip tree, looking up into the depths of heaven above. "A sign," I said. "I didn't quite expect you to be so prompt about it, though." Chapter 2. Dutch Cabin. March 1773. No one had known the cabin was there until Kenny Lindsay had seen the flames on his way up the creek. "I wouldn't have seen it at all," he said, for perhaps the 6th time, "save for the dark coming on. Had it been daylight, I'd never have kent it, never." He wiped a trembling hand over his face, unable to take his eyes off the line of bodies that lay at the edge of the forest. "Was it savages, MacDhu? They're no scalped, but maybe..." "No." Jamie laid the soot-smeared handkerchief gently back over the staring blue face of a small girl. "None of them is wounded. Surely you saw as much when you brought them out." Lindsay shook his head, eyes closed, and shivered convulsively. It was late afternoon and a chilly spring day, but the men were all sweating.
I didn't look, he said simply.
My own hands were like ice, as numb and unfeeling as the rubbery flesh of the dead woman I was examining. They had been dead for more than a day. The rigour of death had passed off, leaving them limp and chilled. But the cold weather of the mountain spring had preserved them so far from the grosser indignities of putrefaction. Still, I breathed shallowly. The air was bitter with the scent of burning. Wisps of steam rose now and then from the charred ruin of the tiny cabin. From the corner of my eye, I saw Roger kick at a nearby log, then bend and pick up something from the ground beneath. Kenny had pounded on our door long before daylight, summoning us from warm beds. We had come in haste, even knowing that we were far too late to offer aid. Some of the tenants from the homesteads on Fraser's Ridge had come, too. Kenny's brother Evan stood with Fergus and Ronnie Sinclair in a small knot under the trees, talking together in low-voiced Gaelic.
"D'ye ken what did for them, Sasnach?"
Jamie squatted beside me, face troubled.
"The ones under the trees, that is."
He nodded at the corpse in front of me.
"I ken what killed this poor woman."
The woman's long skirt stirred in the wind, lifting to show long, slender feet shod in leather clogs. A pair of long hands to match lay still at her sides. She had been tall,
though not so tall as Brianna, I thought,
and looked automatically for my daughter's bright hair bobbing among the branches on the far side of the clearing. I had turned the woman's apron up to cover her head and upper body. Her hands were red, rough-knuckled with work, and with calloused palms, but from the firmness of her thighs and the slenderness of her body, I thought she was no more than 30, likely much younger.
No one could say whether she had been pretty.
I shook my head at his remark. "I don't think she died of the burning," I said. "See, her legs and feet aren't touched. She must have fallen into the hearth. Her hair caught fire and it spread to the shoulders of her gown. She must have lain near enough to the wall or the chimney hood for the flames to touch. That caught, then the whole bloody place went up." Jamie nodded slowly, eyes on the dead woman.
"Aye, that makes sense. But what was it killed them, Sasnach? The others are singed a bit, though none are burned like this. But they must have been dead before the cabin caught alight, for none of them ran out. Was it a deadly illness, perhaps?"
"I don't think so. Let me look at the others again." I walked slowly down the row of still bodies with their cloth-covered faces, stooping over each one to peer again beneath the makeshift shrouds. There were any number of illnesses that could be quickly fatal in these days, with no antibiotics to hand, and no way of administering fluids save by mouth or rectum. A simple case of diarrhea could kill within 24 hours. I saw such things often enough to recognize them easily. Any doctor does. And I had been a doctor for more than 20 years. I saw things now and then in this century that I had never encountered in my own, particularly horrible parasitical diseases brought with the slave trade from the tropics. But it was no parasite that had done for these poor souls, and no illness that I knew to leave such traces on its victims. All the bodies, the burned woman, a much older woman, and 3 children, had been found inside the walls of the flaming house. Kenny had pulled them out just before the roof fell in, then ridden for help. All dead before the fire started. All dead virtually at the same time then, for surely the fire had begun to smoulder soon after the woman fell dead on her hearth. The victims had been laid out neatly under the branches of a giant red spruce, while the men began to dig a grave nearby. Brianna stood by the smallest girl, her head bent. I came to kneel by the little body, and she knelt down across from me. "What was it?" she asked quietly.
"Poison."
I glanced up at her in surprise.
"I think so."
"What gave you that idea?" She nodded at the blue-tinged face below us. She had tried to close the eyes, but they bulged beneath the lids, giving the little girl a look of startled horror. The small, blunt features were twisted in a rictus of agony, and there were traces of vomit in the corners of the mouth.
"Girl Scout handbook," Brianna said.
She glanced at the men, but no one was near enough to hear. Her mouth twitched, and she looked away from the body, holding out her open hand.
"Never eat any strange mushroom," she quoted. "There are many poisonous varieties, and distinguishing one from another is a job for an expert."
"Roger found these, growing in a ring by that log over there."
Moist, fleshy caps, a pale brown with white, warty spots, the open gills and slender stems so pale as to look almost phosphorescent in the spruce shadows. They had a pleasant, earthy look to them that belied their deadliness. "Panther toadstools," I said, half to myself, and picked one gingerly from her palm. "Agaricus pantherinus. Oh, that's what they will be called once somebody gets round to naming them properly. Pantherinus because they kill so swiftly, like a striking cat." I could see the goose flesh ripple on Brianna's forearm, raising the soft red-gold hairs. She tilted her hand and spilled the rest of the deadly fungus on the ground.
"Who in their right mind would eat toadstools?" she asked, wiping her hand on her skirt with a slight shudder.
"People who didn't know better.
People who were hungry, perhaps," I answered softly.
I picked up the little girl's hand and traced the delicate bones of the forearm. The small belly showed signs of bloat, whether from malnutrition or post-mortem change I couldn't tell, but the collarbones were sharp as scythe blades. All of the bodies were thin, though not to the point of emaciation. I looked up into the deep blue shadows of the mountainside above the cabin. It was early in the year for foraging, but there was food in abundance in the forest, for those who could recognize it. Jamie came and knelt down beside me, a big hand lightly on my back. Cold as it was, a trickle of sweat streaked his neck, and his thick auburn hair was dark at the temples.
"The grave is ready," he said,
speaking low as though he might alarm the child.
"Is that what killed the bairn?"
He nodded at the scattered fungi.
"I think so. And the rest of them, too. Have you had a look around? Does anyone know who they were?"
He shook his head.
"Not English. The clothes are wrong. Germans would have gone to Salem, surely. They're clannish souls, and no inclined to settle on their own. These were maybe Dutchmen."
He nodded toward the carved wooden clogs on the old woman's feet, cracked and stained with long use.
"No books nor writing left, if there was any to begin with. Nothing that might tell their name, but..."
"They hadn't been here long."
A low, cracked voice made me look up. Roger had come. He squatted next to Brianna, nodding toward the smouldering remains of the cabin. A small garden plot had been scratched into the earth nearby, but the few plants showing were no more than sprouts, the tender leaves limp and blackened with late frost. There were no sheds, no sign of livestock, no mule or pig.
"New emigrants," Roger said softly. "Not bond servants. This was a family. They weren't used to outdoor labour either. The women's hands have blisters and fresh scars."
His own broad hand rubbed unconsciously over a homespun knee. His palms were as smoothly calloused as Jamie's now, but he had once been a tender-skinned scholar. He remembered the pain of his seasoning.
"I wonder if they left people behind. In Europe," Brianna murmured.
She smoothed blonde hair off the little girl's forehead and laid the kerchief back over her face. I saw her throat move as she swallowed.
"They'll never know what happened to them."
"No."
Jamie stood abruptly.
"They do say that God protects fools, but I think even the Almighty will lose patience now and then."
He turned away, motioning to Lindsay and Sinclair.
"Look for the man," he said to Lindsay.
Every head jerked up to look at him.
"Man?"
Roger said. and then glanced sharply at the burned remnants of the cabin, realization dawning.
Aye. Who built the cabin for them?
The women could have done it, Bree said, lifting her chin.
You could, aye, he said, mouth twitching slightly as he cast a sidelong look at his wife.
Brianna resembled Jamie in more than colouring. She stood 6 feet in her stockings and had her father's clean-limbed strength.
Perhaps they could, but they didn't, Jamie said shortly.
He nodded toward the shell of the cabin, where a few bits of furniture still held their fragile shapes. As I watched, the evening wind came down, scouring the ruin, and the shadow of a stool collapsed noiselessly into ash, flurries of soot and char moving ghost-like over the ground.
What do you mean?
I stood and moved beside him, looking into the house. There was virtually nothing left inside, though the chimney stack still stood, and jagged bits of the walls remained, their logs fallen like jackstraws.
There's no metal, he said, nodding at the blackened hearth where the remnants of a cauldron lay, cracked in two from the heat, its contents vaporized. No pots, save that. And that's too heavy to carry away. Nae tools. Not a knife, not an axe. And you see, whoever built it had that.
I did. The logs were unpeeled, but the notches and ends bore the clear marks of an axe. Frowning, Roger picked up a long pine branch and began to poke through the piles of ash and rubble, looking to be sure. Kenny, Lindsay and Sinclair didn't bother. Jamie had told them to look for a man, and they promptly went to do so, disappearing into the forest. Fergus went with them. Evan Lindsay, his brother Murdo, and the McGilvrys began the chore of collecting stones for a cairn.
If there was a man, did he leave them?
Brianna murmured to me, glancing from her father to the row of bodies.
Did the woman maybe think they wouldn't survive on their own?
And thus take her own life, and those of her children, to avoid a long, drawn-out death from cold and starvation?
Leave them, and take all their tools?
God, I hope not.
I crossed myself at the thought, though even as I did so, I doubted it.
Wouldn't they have walked out looking for help?
Even with children, the snow's mostly gone. Only the highest mountain passes were still packed with snow, and while the trails and slopes were wet and muddy with runoff, they'd been passable for a month at least.
I've phoned the man, Roger said, interrupting my thoughts.
He spoke very calmly, but paused to clear his throat.
Just here.
The daylight was beginning to fade, but I could see that he had gone pale. No wonder. The curled form he had unearthed beneath the charred timbers of a fallen wall was sufficiently gruesome as to give anyone pause. Charred to blackness, hands upraised in the boxer's pose so common to those dead by fire, it was difficult even to be sure that it was a man. Though I thought it was, from what I could see. Speculation about this new body was interrupted by a shout from the forest's edge.
We've found them, my lord.
Everyone looked up from contemplation of this new corpse to see Fergus waving from the edge of the wood. Them, indeed. Two men this time, sprawled on the ground, within the shadow of the trees, found not together, but not far apart, only a short distance from the house. And both, so far as I could tell, probably dead of mushroom poisoning.
That's no Dutchman, Sinclair said for probably the fourth time, shaking his head over one body. He might be, said Fergus dubiously.
He scratched his nose with the tip of the hook he wore in replacement of his left hand.
From the Indies, no?
One of the unknown bodies was, in fact, that of a black man. The other was white, and both wore nondescript clothes of worn homespun, shirts and breeches. No jackets, despite the cold weather. And both were barefoot.
No.
Jamie shook his head, rubbing one hand unconsciously on his own breeches, as though to rid himself of the touch of the dead.
The Dutch keep slaves on Barbuda, aye, but these are better fed than the folk from the cabin.
He lifted his chin toward the silent row of women and children.
They did not live here. Besides,
I saw his eyes fix on the dead men's feet. The feet were grubby about the ankles and heavily calloused, but basically clean. The soles of the black man's feet showed yellowish pink, with no smears of mud or random leaves stuck between the toes. These men hadn't been walking through the muddy forest barefoot, that much was sure.
So there were perhaps more men, and when these died, their companions took their shoes. And anything else of value?
Fergus added practically, gesturing from the burned cabin to the stripped bodies.
And fled? Aye, maybe.
Jamie pursed his lips, his gaze travelling slowly over the earth of the yard. But the ground was churned with footsteps, clumps of grass uprooted, and the whole of the yard dusted with ash and bits of charred wood. It looked as though the place had been ravaged by rampaging hippopotami.
I could wish that young Ian was here. He's the best of the trackers. He could maybe tell what happened there, at least.
He nodded into the wood where the men had been found.
How many there were, maybe, and which way they've gone.
Jamie himself was no mean tracker, but the light was going fast now. Even in the clearing where the burned cabin stood, the dark was rising, pooling under the trees, creeping like oil across the shattered earth. His eyes went to the horizon, where streamers of cloud were beginning to blaze with gold and pink as the sun set behind them, and he shook his head.
Bury them. Then we'll go.
One more grim discovery remained. Alone among the dead, the burned man had not died of fire or poison. When they lifted the charred corpse from the ashes to bear him to his grave, something fell free of the body, landing with a small, heavy thunk on the ground. Brianna picked it up and rubbed at it with the corner of her apron. "I guess they overlooked this," she said, a little bleakly, holding it out. It was a knife, or the blade of one. The wooden hilt had burned entirely away, and the blade itself was warped with heat. Steeling myself against the thick, acrid stench of burned fat and flesh, I bent over the corpse, poking gingerly at the midsection. Fire destroys a great deal, but preserves the strangest things. The triangular wound was quite clear, seared in the hollow beneath his ribs. "They stabbed him," I said, and wiped my sweating hands on my own apron. "They killed him," Bree said, watching my face. "And then his wife..." She glanced at the young woman on the ground, the concealing apron over her head. "She made a stew with the mushrooms, and they all ate it. The children, too." The clearing was silent, save for the distant calls of birds on the mountain. I could hear my own heart beating painfully in my chest. Vengeance? Or simple despair?
"Aye, maybe," Jamie said quietly.
He stooped to pick up an end of the sheet of canvas they had placed the dead man on.
"We'll call it accident."
The Dutchman and his family were laid in one grave, the two strangers in another. A cold wind had sprung up as the sun went down. The apron fluttered away from the woman's face as they lifted her. Sinclair gave a strangled cry of shock and nearly dropped her. She had neither face nor hair any more. The slender waist narrowed abruptly into charred ruin. The flesh of her head had burned away completely, leaving an oddly tiny, blackened skull from which her teeth grinned in disconcerting levity. They lowered her hastily into the shallow grave, her children beside her, and left Brianna and me to build a small cairn over them, in the ancient Scottish way, to mark the place, and provide protection from wild beasts, while a more rudimentary resting place was dug for the two barefoot men. The work finally done, everyone gathered, white-faced and silent, around the new-made mounds. I saw Roger stand close beside Brianna, his arm protectively about her waist. A small shudder went through her, which I thought had nothing to do with the cold. Their child, Jemmy, was a year or so younger than the smallest girl.
"Will you speak a word, MacDhu?" Kenny Lindsay glanced inquiringly at Jamie, pulling his knitted bonnet down over his ears against the growing chill. It was nearly nightfall, and no one wanted to linger. We would have to make camp somewhere well away from the stink of burning, and that would be hard enough in the dark. But Kenny was right. We couldn't leave without at least some token of ceremony, some farewell for the strangers. Jamie shook his head.
"Nay, let Roger Mack speak. If these were Dutchmen, belike they were Protestant."
Dim as the light was, I saw the sharp glance Brianna shot at her father. It was true that Roger was a Presbyterian. So was Tom Christie, a much older man, whose dour face reflected his opinion of the proceedings. The question of religion was no more than a pretext, though, and everyone knew it, including Roger. Roger cleared his throat with a noise like tearing calico. It was always a painful sound. There was anger in it now as well. He didn't protest, though, and he met Jamie's eyes straight on as he took his place at the head of the grave. I had thought he would simply say the Lord's Prayer, or perhaps one of the gentler psalms. Other words came to him, though.
"Behold, I cry out of wrong, but I am not heard. I cry aloud, but there is no judgment. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he hath set darkness in my paths."
His voice had once been powerful and beautiful. It was choked now, no more than a rasping shadow of its former beauty. But there was sufficient power in the passion with which he spoke to make all those who heard him bow their heads, faces lost in shadow.
"He hath stripped me of my glory, and taken the crown from my head. He hath destroyed me on every side, and I am gone. And my hope hath he removed like a tree."
His face was set, but his eyes rested for a bleak moment on the charred stump that had served the Dutch family for a chopping block.
"He hath put my brethren far from me, and mine acquaintance are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me."
I saw the three Lindsay brothers exchange glances, and everyone drew a little closer together against the rising wind.
"Have pity upon me. Have pity upon me, O ye my friends," he said.
And his voice softened, so that it was difficult to hear him above the sighing of the trees.
"For the hand of God has touched me."
Brianna made a slight movement beside him, and he cleared his throat once more explosively, stretching his neck so that I caught a glimpse of the rope scar that marred it.
"Oh, that my words were now written! Oh, that they were printed in a book! That they were graven with an iron pen, and laid in the rock for ever."
He looked slowly round from face to face, his own expressionless, then took a deep breath to continue, voice cracking on the words.
"For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body..."
Brianna shuddered convulsively and looked away from the raw mound of earth.
"Yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold."
He stopped. There was a brief collective sigh as everyone let out the breath they had been holding. He wasn't quite finished, though. He had reached out, half unconsciously, for Bree's hand, and held it tightly. He spoke the last words almost to himself, I thought, with little thought for his listeners.
"Be ye afraid of the sword, for wrath bringeth the punishments of the sword, that ye may know there is a judgment."
I shivered, and Jamie's hand curled round my own, cold but strong. He looked down at me, and I met his eyes. I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking, as I was, not of the present, but the future, of a small item that would appear 3 years hence in the pages of the Wilmington Gazette, dated February the 13th, 1776.
"It is with grief that the news is received of the deaths by fire of James Mackenzie Fraser and his wife, Claire Fraser, in a conflagration that destroyed their house in the settlement of Fraser's Ridge on the night of January the 21st last. Mr. Fraser, a nephew of the late Hector Cameron of River Run Plantation, was born at Broch Turach in Scotland. He was widely known in the colony and deeply respected. He leaves no surviving children."
It had been easy so far not to think too much of it. So far in the future, and surely not an unchangeable future. After all, forewarned was forearmed, wasn't it? I glanced at the shallow cairn, and a deeper chill passed through me. I stepped closer to Jamie and put my other hand on his arm. He covered my hand with his and squeezed tight in reassurance.
"No," he said to me silently. "No, I will not let it happen."
As we left the desolate clearing, though, I couldn't free my mind of one vivid image. Not the burned cabin, the pitiful bodies, the pathetic dead garden. The image that haunted me was one I had seen some years before, a gravestone in the ruins of Bewley Priory, high in the Scottish Highlands. It was the tomb of a noble lady, her name surmounted by the carving of a grinning skull, very like the one beneath the Dutch woman's apron. Beneath the skull was her motto: "Hodie mihi cras tibi, sic transit gloria mundi." My turn today, yours tomorrow. Thus passes the glory of the world. Chapter 3. Keep your friends close. We returned to Fraser's Ridge just before sunset the next day to discover a visitor waiting. Major Donald MacDonald, late of His Majesty's Army, and even more lately of Governor Tryon's personal light horse guard, was sitting on the front stoop, my cat in his lap, and a jug of beer beside him.
"Mrs. Fraser, your servant, mum," he called genially, seeing me approach.
He tried to stand up, but then let out a gasp as Adso, objecting to the loss of his cosy nest, dug his claws into the Major's thighs. "Do sit, Major," I said, waving him hastily back. He subsided with a grimace, but nobly refrained from flinging Adso into the bushes. I came up onto the stoop beside him and sat down, sighing with relief. "My husband is just seeing to the horses. He'll be down directly. I see that someone's made you welcome." I nodded at the beer, which he promptly offered to me with a courtly gesture, wiping the neck of the jug on his sleeve.
"Oh, yes, mum,"
he assured me.
"Mrs. Bug has been most assiduous of my welfare."
Not to seem uncordial, I accepted the beer, which in all truth went down very well. Jamie had been anxious to get back, and we'd been in the saddle since dawn, with only a brief break for refreshment at midday.
"It is a most excellent brew," the Major said, smiling, as I exhaled after swallowing, my eyes half closing. "Your own making, perhaps?"
I shook my head and took another swallow before handing the jug back to him. "No, it's Lizzie's. Lizzie Weems."
"Oh, your bond maid. Yes, of course. Will you give her my compliments?"
"Isn't she here?"
I glanced toward the open door behind him, rather surprised. At this time of day, I would have expected Lizzie to be in the kitchen making supper, but she would surely have heard our arrival and come out. There was no smell of cooking, now that I noticed. She wouldn't have known when to expect us, of course, but... No. She is... The Major knitted his brows in the effort of recall, and I wondered how full the jug had been before he got at it. There were no more than a couple of inches left now. Ah, yes. She went to the McGillivrys with her father, Mrs. Bugg said. To visit her affianced, I believe.
Yes, she's engaged to Manfred McGillivray, but Mrs. Bugg?
As in the Springhouse, he said, with a nod up the hill towards the small shed. A matter of cheese, I believe she said. An omelette was most graciously proposed for my supper.
Ah, I relaxed a bit more, the dust of the ride settling with the beer. It was wonderful to come home, though my sense of peace was uneasy, tainted by the memory of the burned cabin. I supposed that Mrs. Bugg would have told him our errand, but he made no reference to it, nor to whatever had brought him up to the ridge. Naturally not. All business would wait appropriately for Jamie. Being female, I would get impeccable courtesy and small bits of social gossip in the meantime. I could do social gossip, but needed to be prepared for it. I hadn't a natural knack.
Ah, your relations with my cats seem somewhat improved, I hazarded.
I glanced involuntarily at his head, but his wig had been expertly mended.
It is an accepted principle of politics, I believe, he said, ruffling his fingers through the thick silver fur on Adso's belly. Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Very sound, I said, smiling. I hope you haven't been waiting long.
He shrugged, intimating that any wait was irrelevant, which it generally was.
The mountains had their own time, and a wise man didn't try to hurry them. MacDonald was a seasoned soldier and well-travelled, but he had been born in Pitlochry, close enough to the Highland Peaks to know their ways.
"I came this morning," he said, "from New Bern."
Small warning bells went off in the back of my mind. It would have taken him a good 10 days to travel from New Bern, if he had come directly, and the state of his creased and mud-stained uniform suggested that he had. New Bern was where the new royal governor of the colony, Josiah Martin, had taken up his residence. And for MacDonald to have said, "from New Bern," rather than mentioning some later stop on his journey, made it reasonably plain to me that whatever business had impelled this visit, it had originated in New Bern. I was wary of governors. I glanced towards the path that led to the paddock, but Jamie wasn't visible yet. Mrs. Bugg was, emerging from the springhouse. I waved to her, and she gestured enthusiastically in welcome, though hampered by a pail of milk in one hand, a bucket of eggs in the other, a crock of butter under one arm, and a large chunk of cheese tucked neatly underneath her chin. She negotiated the steep descent with success, and disappeared round the back of the house toward the kitchen. "Omelettes all round, it looks like," I remarked, turning back to the Major. "Did you happen to come through Cross Creek by chance?"
"I did indeed, Mum. Your husband's aunt sends you her kind regards, and a quantity of books and newspapers, which I have brought with me."
I was wary of newspapers these days, too, though such events as they reported had undoubtedly taken place several weeks or months previously. I made appreciative noises, though, wishing Jamie would hurry up, so I could excuse myself. My hair smelled of burning, and my hands still remembered the touch of cold flesh. I wanted a wash badly. "I beg your pardon?" I had missed something MacDonald was saying. He bent politely closer to repeat it.
then jerked suddenly, eyes bulging.
"Frigging cat!"
Adsel, who had been doing a splendid imitation of a limp dishcloth, had sprung bolt upright in the Major's lap, eyes glowing and tail like a bottle brush, hissing like a tea kettle as he flexed his claws hard into the Major's legs. I hadn't time to react before he had leapt over MacDonald's shoulder and swarmed through the open surgery window behind him, ripping the Major's ruffle and knocking his wig askew in the process. MacDonald was cursing freely, but I hadn't attention to spare for him. Rollo was coming up the path toward the house, wolf-like and sinister in the gloaming, but acting so oddly that I was standing before conscious thought could bring me to my feet. The dog would run a few steps toward the house, circle once or twice as though unable to decide what to do next, then run back into the wood, turn, and run again toward the house, all the while whining with agitation, tail low and wavering. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said. "Bloody Timmy's in the well." I flew down the steps and ran for the path, barely registering the Major's startled oath behind me. I found Ian a few hundred yards down the path, conscious but groggy. He was sitting on the ground, eyes closed, and both hands holding his head as though to keep the bones of his skull from coming apart. He opened his eyes as I dropped to my knees beside him and gave me an unfocused smile.
"Auntie," he said hoarsely.
He seemed to want to say something else, but couldn't quite decide what. His mouth opened, but then simply hung that way, tongue moving thoughtfully to and fro.
"Look at me, Ian," I said, as calmly as possible. He did. That was good. It was too dark to see whether his pupils were unnaturally dilated, but even in the evening shadow of the pines that edged the trail, I could see the pallor of his face and the dark trail of blood stains down his shirt. Hurried steps were coming after me down the trail. Jamie, followed closely by MacDonald.
"How is it, lad?"
Jamie gripped him by one arm, and Ian swayed very gently toward him, then dropped his hands, closed his eyes, and relaxed into Jamie's arms with a sigh.
"Is he bad?"
Jamie spoke anxiously over Ian's shoulder, holding him up as I frisked him for damage. The back of his shirt was saturated with dried blood, but it was dried. The tail of his hair was stiff with it too, and I found the head wound quickly. "I don't think so. Something's hit him hard on the head and taken out a chunk of his scalp, but..."
"A tomahawk, do you think?"
MacDonald leaned over us, intent.
"No," said Ian drowsily, his face muffled in Jamie's shirt. "A ball."
"Go away, dog,"
Jamie said briefly to Rollo, who had stuck his nose in Ian's ear, eliciting a stifled squawk from the patient, and an involuntary lifting of his shoulders. "I'll have a look in the light, but it may not be too bad," I said, observing this. "He walked some way, after all. Let's get him up to the house." The men made shift to get him up the trail, Ian's arms over their shoulders, and within minutes had him laid face down on the table in my surgery. Here he told us the story of his adventures in a disjoint fashion, punctuated by small yelps as I cleaned the injury, clipped bits of clotted hair away, and put 5 or 6 stitches into his scalp.
"I thought I was dead," Ian said,
and sucked air through his teeth as I drew the coarse thread through the edges of the ragged wound.
"Christ, Auntie Claire!"
"I woke in the morning, though, and I wasn't dead after all, though I thought my head was split open and my brain spilling down my neck."
"Very nearly was," I murmured, concentrating on my work. "I don't think it was a bullet, though."
That got everyone's attention.
"I'm not shot."
Ian sounded mildly indignant. One big hand lifted, straying toward the back of his head, and I slapped it lightly away.
"Keep still."
"No, you aren't shot. No credit to you." "There was a deal of dirt in the wound, and shreds of wood and tree bark. If I had to guess, one of the shots knocked a dead branch loose from a tree and it hit you in the head when it fell.
You're quite sure as it wasn't a tomahawk, are you?
The Major seemed disappointed, too. I tied the final knot and clipped the thread, shaking my head. I don't believe I've ever seen a tomahawk wound, but I don't think so. See how jagged the edges are, and the scalp's torn badly, but I don't believe the bone is fractured.
It was pitch dark, the lad said,
Jamie put in logically.
No sensible person would fling a tomahawk into a dark wood at something he couldn't see.
He was holding the spirit lamp for me to work by. He moved it closer so we could see not only the ragged line of stitches, but the spreading bruise around it, revealed by the hair I had clipped off.
Aye, see?
Jamie's finger spread the remaining bristles gently apart, tracing several deep scratches that scored the bruised area.
Your aunt is right, Ian. You've been attacked by a tree.
Ian opened one eye a slit.
Has anyone ever told you what a comical fella you are, Uncle Jamie?
No.
Ian closed the eye.
That's as well, because you're not.
Jamie smiled and squeezed Ian's shoulder.
Feeling a bit better then, are you?
No.
Ah, well, the thing is, Major MacDonald interrupted, that the lad did meet with some sort of banditti, no? Had you reason to think they might be Indians?
No, said Ian again.
But this time he opened the eye all the way. It was bloodshot.
They weren't.
MacDonald didn't appear pleased with this answer.
How could you be sure, lad?
He asked rather sharply.
If it was dark, as you say.
I saw Jamie glance quizzically at the Major, but he didn't interrupt. Ian moaned a little, then heaved a sigh and answered.
I smelt them, he said, adding almost immediately, I think I'm going to puke.
He raised himself on one elbow and promptly did so. This effectively put an end to any further questions, and Jamie took Major MacDonald off to the kitchen, leaving me to clean Ian up and settle him as comfortably as I could. Can you open both eyes? I asked, having got him tidied and resting on his side with a pillow under his head. He did, blinking a little at the light. The small blue flame of the spirit lamp was reflected twice over in the darkness of his eyes, but the pupils shrank at once, and together.
That's good, I said,
and put down the lamp on the table.
Leave it, dog,
I said to Rollo, who was nosing at the strange smell of the lamp. It was burning a mix of low-grade brandy and turpentine.
Take hold of my fingers, Ian.
I held out my index fingers, and he slowly wrapped a large, bony hand round each of them. I put him through the drill for neurological damage, having him squeeze, pull, push, and then concluded by listening to his heart, which was thumping along reassuringly.
Slight concussion, I announced, straightening up and smiling at him.
Why?
He asked, squinting up at me.
It means your head aches and you feel sick. You'll feel better in a few days.
I could have told you that,
he muttered, settling back.
So you could, I agreed. But concussion sounds so much more important than cracked head, doesn't it?
He didn't laugh, but smiled faintly in response.
Will you feed Rollo, Auntie? He wouldn't have leave me on the way. He'll be hungry.
Rollo pricked his ears at the sound of his name and shoved his muzzle into Ian's groping hand, whining softly.
He's fine, I said to the dog. Don't worry.
And yes, I added to Ian, I'll bring something. Do you think you could manage a bit of bread and milk yourself?
No,
he said definitely.
A dram of whiskey, maybe?
No, I said, just as definitely, and blew out the spirit lamp.
Auntie,
he said, as I turned to the door.
Yes.
I left a single candlestick to light him,
and he looked very young and pale in the wavering yellow glow.
"Why do you suppose Major MacDonald wants it to be Indians I met in the wood?"
"I don't know. But I imagine Jamie does.
Or will by now."
Chapter 4. Serpent in Eden. Brianna pushed open the door to her cabin, listening warily for the scamper of rodent feet or the dry whisper of scales across the floor. She'd once walked in the dark, and stepped within inches of a small rattlesnake. While the snake had been nearly as startled as she was and slithered madly away between the hearthstones, she'd learned her lesson. There was no scuttling of fleeing mice or voles this time, but something larger had been and gone, pushing its way through the oiled skin tacked over the window. The sun was just setting, and there was enough daylight left to show her the woven grass basket in which she kept roasted peanuts, knocked from its shelf onto the floor, and the contents cracked and eaten, a litter of shells scattered over the floor. A loud rustling noise froze her momentarily, listening. It came again, followed by a loud clang as something fell to the ground on the other side of the back wall.
"You little bastard," she said. "You're in my pantry."
Fired with righteous indignation, she seized the broom and charged into the lean-to with a banshee yell. An enormous raccoon, tranquilly munching a smoked trout, dropped its prey at sight of her, dashed between her legs, and made off like a fat banker in flight from creditors, making loud brrring noises of alarm. Nerves pulsing with adrenaline, she put aside the broom and bent to salvage what she could of the mess, cursing under her breath. Raccoons were less destructive than squirrels, who would chew and shred with hapless abandon, but they had bigger appetites. God knew how long he'd been in here, she thought, long enough to lick all the butter out of its mould, pull down a cluster of smoked fish from the rafters, and how something so fat had managed the acrobatic feat required for that. Luckily, the honeycomb had been stored in 3 separate jars, and only one had been despoiled. But the root vegetables had been dumped on the floor, a fresh cheese mostly devoured, and the precious jug of maple syrup had been overturned, draining into a sticky puddle in the dirt. The sight of this loss enraged her afresh, and she squeezed the potato she had just picked up so hard that her nail sank through its skin. Bloody, bloody, beastly, horrible, bloody beast! Who? Said a voice behind her. Startled, she whirled and fired the potato at the intruder, who proved to be Roger. It struck him squarely on the forehead, and he staggered, clutching the door frame.
Oh, Christ! Ow! Oh, what the hell's going on in here?
Raccoon, she said shortly, and stepped back, letting the waning light from the door illuminate the damage.
He got the maple syrup, bugger! Did you get the bastard?
Hand pressed to his forehead, Roger ducked inside the lean-to pantry, glancing about for furry bodies. Seeing that her husband shared both her priorities and her sense of outrage soothed her somewhat.
No, she said. He ran. Are you bleeding? And where's Jem? I don't think so, he said, taking the hand gingerly from his forehead and glancing at it. Oh! You've a wicked arm, girl. Jem's at the McGillivrys. Lizzie and Mr. Weems took him along to celebrate Sanger's engagement.
Really? Who did she pick?
Both outrage and remorse were immediately subsumed in interest. Uta McGillivray, with German thoroughness, had carefully selected partners for her son and 3 daughters, according to her own criteria. Land, money and respectability ranking highest, with age, personal appearance, and charm coming well down the list. Not surprisingly, her children had other ideas, though such was the force of Frau Uta's personality that both Inga and Hilda had married men that she approved of. Sanger, though, was her mother's daughter, meaning that she possessed similarly strong opinions and a similar lack of inhibition in expressing them.
For months, she had been hovering between two suitors, Heinrich Strasser, a dashing but poor young man, and a Lutheran from Bethania, and Ronnie Sinclair, the cooper. A well-off man, by standards of the Ridge, and to Uta, the fact that Ronnie was 30 years Sanger's senior was no bar. The business of Sanger McGillivray's marriage had been a topic of intense speculation on the Ridge for the last several months, and Brianna was aware of several substantial wagers riding on the outcome.
"So who's the lucky man?" she repeated. "Mrs. Bug doesn't know, and it's driving her mad," Roger replied, breaking into a grin. "Manfred McGillivray came to fetch them yesterday morning, but Mrs. Bug hadn't come down to the big house yet, so Lizzie left a note pinned to the back door to say where they'd gone. But she didn't think to say who the fortunate bridegroom is."
Brianna glanced at the setting sun. The orb itself had sunk out of sight, though the blazing light through the chestnut trees still lit the dooryard, making the spring grass look deep and soft as emerald velvet.
"I suppose we'll have to wait till tomorrow to find out," she said, with some regret.
The McGillivrays' place was a good 5 miles. It would be full dark long before they reached it, and even past the thaw, one didn't wander the mountains at night without a good reason, or at least a better reason than mere curiosity.
"Aye. Do you want to go up to the big house for supper? Major MacDonald's come."
"Oh, him."
She considered for a moment.
She would like to hear any news that the Major had brought, and there was something to be said for having Mrs. Bug make supper. On the other hand, she was really in no mood to be sociable, after a grim 3 days, a long ride, and the desecration of her pantry. She became aware that Roger was carefully not contributing an opinion. One arm leaning against the shelf where the dwindling stock of winter apples was spread, he idly caressed one of the fruits, a forefinger slowly stroking the round yellow cheek of it. Faint, familiar vibrations were coming off him, suggesting silently that there might be advantages to an evening at home, sans parents, acquaintances, or baby. She smiled at Roger.
"How's your poor head?"
He glanced at her briefly, the waning rays of the sun gilding the bridge of his nose and striking a flash of green from one eye.
He cleared his throat. "I suppose you might kiss it," he suggested diffidently. "If you liked."
She obligingly rose on her tiptoes and did so, gently, brushing back the thick black hair from his brow. There was a noticeable lump, though it hadn't begun to bruise yet.
"Is that better?" "Not yet. Better try again. Maybe a bit lower."
His hands settled on the swell of her hips, drawing her in. She was nearly as tall as he was. She'd noticed before what an advantage of fit this was, but the impression struck her forcibly anew. She wriggled slightly, enjoying it, and Roger drew a deep, rasping breath.
"Not quite that low," he said. "Not yet, anyway."
"Picky, picky," she said tolerantly, and kissed him on the mouth. His lips were warm, but the scent of bitter ash and damp earth clung to him, as it did to her, and she shivered a little, drawing back. He kept a hand lightly on her back, but leaned past her, running a finger along the edge of the shelf where the jug of maple syrup had been overturned. He ran the finger lightly along her lower lip, then his own, and bent again to kiss her, sweetness rising up between them.
"I can't remember how long it's been since I've seen you naked."
She closed one eye and looked at him skeptically.
"About 3 days. I guess it wasn't all that memorable."
It had been a great relief to shed the clothes she'd been wearing for the last 3 days and nights. Even naked and hastily washed, though, she still smelled dust in her hair and felt the grime of the journey between her toes.
Oh, well, aye. That's not what I mean, though. I mean, it's been a long while since we've made love in the daylight.
He lay on his side, facing her, and smiled as he passed a light hand over the deep curve of her waist and the swell of buttock.
You've no idea how lovely you look, stark naked with the sun behind you. All gold, like you were dipped in it.
He closed one eye, as though the sight dazzled him. She moved, and the sun shone in his face, making the open eye glow like an emerald in the split second before he blinked. She put out a lazy hand and drew his head in close to kiss him. She did know what he meant. It felt strange, almost wicked, in a pleasant sort of way. Most often they made love at night, after Jem was asleep, whispering to each other in the half-lit shadows, finding each other among the rustling, secret layers of quilts and nightclothes. And while Jem normally slept as though he'd been poleaxed, they were always half-conscious of the small, heavy-breathing mound beneath the quilt of his trundle bed nearby. She was oddly just as conscious of Jem now, in his absence. It felt strange to be apart from him, not constantly aware of where he was, not feeling his body as a small, very mobile extension of her own. The freedom was exhilarating, but left her feeling uneasy, as though she'd misplaced something valuable. They'd left the door open, the better to enjoy the flood of light and air on their skins. The sun was nearly down now, though, and while the air still glowed like honey, there was a shadow of chill in it. A sudden gust of wind rattled the hide tacked over the window and blew across the room, slamming the door and leaving them abruptly in the dark. Brianna gasped. Roger grunted in surprise and swung off the bed, going to open the door. He flung it wide, and she gulped in the freshet of air and sunshine, only then aware that she had held her breath when the door closed, feeling momentarily entombed. Roger seemed to feel the same. He stood in the doorway, bracing himself against the frame, letting the wind stir the dark, curling hairs of his body. His hair was still bound in a tail. He hadn't bothered undoing it, and she had a sudden desire to come behind him, untie the leather thong, and run her fingers through the soft, glossy black of it. The legacy of some ancient Spaniard shipwrecked among the Celts. She was up and doing it before she had consciously decided to, combing tiny yellow catkins and twigs from his locks with her fingers. He shivered, from her touch or that of the wind, but his body was warm. "You have a farmer's tan," she said, lifting the hair off his neck and kissing him on the bone at the base of his nape.
"Well, so, am I not a farmer, then?"
His skin twitched under her lips like a horse's hide. His face, neck, and forearms had paled over the winter, but were still darker than the flesh of back and shoulders, and a faint line still lingered round his waist, demarcating the soft buckskin colour of his torso from the startling paleness of his backside. She cupped his buttocks, enjoying the high, round solidity of them, and he breathed deeply, leaning back a little toward her, so her breasts pressed against his back and her chin rested on his shoulder, looking out. It was still daylight, but barely. The last long shafts of the sinking sun burst through the chestnut trees, so the tender spring green of their leaves burned with cool fire, brilliant above the lengthening shadows. It was near evening, but it was spring. The birds were still at it, chattering and courting. A mockingbird sang from the forest nearby in a medley of trills, liquid runs, and odd yowls, which, she thought, it must have learned from her mother's cat. The air was growing nippy, and goose flesh stippled her arms and thighs, but Roger's body against her own was very warm. She wrapped her arms around his waist, the fingers of one hand playing idly with the thicket of his short and curlies.
"What are you looking at?"
she asked softly, for his eyes were fixed on the far side of the dooryard where the trail emerged from the forest. The trailhead was dim, shadowed by a growth of dark pines, but empty.
"I'm watching out for a snake bearing apples," he said,
and laughed, then cleared his throat.
"Are you hungry, Eve?"
His hand came down to twine with hers.
"Getting there. Are you?"
"He must be starving. They had had only a hasty snack at midday." I am, but..."
He broke off, hesitating, and his fingers tightened in hers.
"You'll think I'm mad, but would you mind if I went to fetch Wee Jem tonight instead of waiting for the..."